Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am your host and tour guide, Yada. Each weekday morning, I strive to expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism and the media, and with military and economic schemes. If you listen, your eyes may be opened, and you may ultimately change your mind towards these human institutions. Instead of merely presenting the news, my mission today will be to help you understand what is occurring behind the headlines, all while predicting how these events will shape our world over the next 20 years. Then during our second hour, we're going to turn to God. We're going to engage him on his terms by way of his one and only covenant and through his always dependable Torah teaching, so that with his guidance, you will be able to replace your religion with reason and engage in a relationship with him. Our number, should you wish to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is said during this program, is 877-300-7645. This morning, I'd like to begin with the statement that was heard on the SRN News beginning of this program, where the president of Egypt, one of the executives in the Muslim Brotherhood, said that Muslim mothers should nurse their children on hatred for Jews in Israel. And it is, well, that statement is horrific. Well, that statement explains the ongoing nature of the rage that Muslims express, both tangibly and through their words, through their rallies across the Islamic world. It is also invocative of something vastly more troubling. The fact that the United States reacted to it and condemned the statement, saying that there should be no tolerance for anyone who makes statements like these, shows that the United States is universally ignorant of the nature of the Islamic religion. To say that religious hatred is inappropriate and cannot be tolerated in any form is to say that Islam is inappropriate and cannot be tolerated in any form. And why that is a true statement, and why those are rational connections, why is it that our government is incapable of making those connections? If you come to recognize that inspiring children to hate a race of people and you wean them on rage so that they commit themselves to the destruction of a nation, based upon the statements of your wannabe God and his wannabe prophet, then there is no hope for them or for that people. And so it is a tragedy that so many people are ignorant of what Islam teaches. The fact that the Quran is the most anti-Semitic and hateful book ever written. The Quran is far more anti-Semitic, far more hateful than is Hitler's Mein Kampf. You know, this morning we were going to talk a little bit about the Chuck Hagel nomination, his pick for Secretary of Defense. And yet, should we not be more concerned with our nation's lack of understanding of the Quran? I mean, if you want to understand why Israel is singled out in the Middle East and hated by all of its neighbors, all you have to do is read the Quran. Exposing and condemning the Quran would be far more effective in resolving the threats to Israel than would be opposing the nomination of Senator Chuck Hagel. Now, Hagel is not an ideal candidate. He is probably going to be affirmed. I don't think the Republicans have the ability to keep him from being affirmed, particularly in the Senate. And the issues surrounding him are actually fairly minor. He has, while in the Senate, consistently shown an unwillingness to sign any of the letters that are typically signed in the U.S. Congress in support of Israel. He has openly proposed the benefit of negotiating with Iran, of negotiating with Hamas, with Hezbollah, as if these things would be in any way, shape, or form conducive to peace. To suggest that one should negotiate with Iran is to not understand Islam. It is to recognize that it is to fail to recognize that Muslims are specifically taught to lie and to propose agreements that they have no plan to honor. The ninth surah of the Quran speaks directly of this. And when Muhammad had failed to conquer Mecca the previous year, when he had too few men under arms, and then came down the next year to conquer it, after the previous year having signed an oath saying that he would not wage war with Mecca, would not kidnap their children, would not rape their women, would not rob their caravans, and would not attack them for 10 years, Muhammad came down the next year and cited a Quranic revelation that says any treaty between a Muslim and a non-Muslim is not binding on the Muslim. It's the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. Every Muslim is aware of it. And so to negotiate something with a Muslim leader is counterproductive. It's done in the spirit of Hudaybiyah. And so for this man to propose that means that he is ignorant of Islam. Now, to his credit, Hagel is one of the few senators that actually opposed the invasion of Iraq. That was right. He was smart in doing so. He is a devout Roman Catholic. That means that he is either ignorant or irrational. That's probably not a good thing, being put at the head of the largest and most deadly force, military force on earth. But nonetheless, these are the issues that surround this man. He will be affirmed. And the issues that we should be vastly more concerned about are the issues associated with Islam. What I would like to do today is to continue to focus on that part of the world. This story is from CNN. It helps reveal just the universal naivete of non-Muslims regarding the religion of Islam. We all know that there is a terrorist group, an Islamic terrorist group called Boko Haram, that is pummeling Nigeria. They have taken control of northern Nigeria, have imposed Sharia law, and they wish to now invade the south and control all of Nigeria. And so, after thousands of people have been brutally massacred by Boko Haram, this fundamentalist Islamic group, the former Nigerian president, Olusegun Obasanjo, said that more should be done to reach out to the militant Islamic group, Boko Haram, to find out what leads it to carry out acts of violence. Now imagine that. Here you're in a country that is literally being ripped apart in the middle, with thousands of people being murdered by a fundamentalist Islamic terrorist group that explains on a daily basis why they kill. They're reading from the Quran, they're citing the Hadith, and then they're perpetrating their murders based upon those verses, and then when they kill, they claim credit for it, citing from the same sources. And you are so ignorant of Islam, which motivates them, and of their sources. As a former president of Nigeria, you want to reach out to the group to ask them why it kills? Now, in all fairness, I was once in the same place. If you go back 11 years now, on the morning of 9/11, I watched, as so many Americans did in 2001, people fly planes into our buildings. And wanted to know who they were, what motivated them to do something this reprehensible, and what maybe would keep whoever this was from ever doing something like this again. Well, we came to find out in the immediate aftermath of the terrorist suicide bombing that the perpetrators were Muslims. They were fundamentalist Muslims. They were screaming Allahu Akbar as they flew the planes into the building, which means that Allah is greater. Greater than Yahweh is the implication. And so I wanted to ascertain what it was that was motivating them, because immediately after the event, every quote-unquote responsible person, politician and media representative, had a Muslim on their show, an imam, to say that Islam is a loving and peaceful religion and jihad is a spiritual struggle, and this has nothing to do with Islam. So if they were true, if that's true, what did motivate them? So immediately thereafter, I did the same thing that this former Nigerian president is proposing to do. I was naive. I was ignorant as it relates to the nature of Islam. And so I flew across the world to meet with Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Islamic Aska brigades, and I asked them, the Al-Aska brigades, I should say, in Islamic Jihad, I asked them individually, at gunpoint, by the way, not my gun on them, but their guns on me, in a dungeon in the territories they could controlled. I asked them, why did you fly planes into our buildings? And they were proud of their act. I asked them, you know, why are you killing Jews and Christians? And they quoted from their Quran and Hadith. They quoted sayings from their prophet Muhammad. And so I was in the same position that this man was in. I wanted to know why they were carrying out these acts of violence. Why is it that Muslims are responsible for 99.9% of the terrorist acts perpetrated in the world today? And I was ignorant of Islam. I went and met with the terrorists. They quoted Muhammad. They said Muhammad told them to do so. They said Muhammad did so himself. So either they were cherry-picking the worst of Muhammad's deeds and citations out of context, or Islam was the reason they were killing. Those were the only two viable choices. They had corrupted their religion, or their religion had corrupted them. We'll determine which after the break.
The time.
Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We do have David Rubin on the line, calling in from Shiloh, Israel. David has formerly been the mayor of Shiloh. He is the founder of the Shiloh Israel Children's Fund. And he is the author of a book called The Islamic Tsunami, Israel and America in the Age of Obama. It's the title of his book that I find the most intriguing, because I have found very few Israelis that are willing to speak of Islam at all for fear of offending their neighbors. David, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
My understanding, David, is that came to want to know what caused the rage, the killing, the violence perpetrated by the so-called Palestinians, because you yourself and your son were actually victims of a Islamic terrorist attack. Is that correct?
Well, I wouldn't say that I understand the Palestinians because of that alone, but it is certainly a trauma that we went through when I was wounded and my son was wounded when he was 3 years old. So we can't say that we've experienced it personally,
Can you tell me what group was it that attacked you and your son?
Well, they were members of the Palestinian Authority. They came from Ramallah, which is the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority. And I don't have actual proof that they were sent by the Palestinian Authority particularly.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, it doesn't matter to me. The fact is that they were terrorists, they were Islamic terrorists, and they were looking to kill a couple of Jewish civilians on the road.
When back in the fall of 2001, I wanted to know why Muslims thought it was a religious duty to fly planes into our buildings and kill 3,000 Americans. And I went to meet with Islamic terrorists, and I found that the easiest place to do so was in Israel. And I met with the militant arm of Fatah. Fatah and the PLO are one and the same, same organization, both founded in Egypt in a collaborative effort between the Muslim Brotherhood and Yasser Arafat. And the militant wing at the time, back 11 years ago now, of the PLO or Fatah was the Aska Martyrs Brigade. And I met with two officers and an enlisted man of the Aska Martyrs Brigade. And, you know, I asked, why do you perpetrate these acts of violence? Why do you kill? The three men that I met with were particularly giddy that night. This will probably strike a raw nerve with you, David, but I'd still like your reaction to it. The three men I met with that night were giddy. And they were dressed, by the way, in army fatigues. They were carrying United States made AR-15s. They said, you know what happened last night? I said, yes, there was a terrorist act on a bus on the road to Emmanuel. They, 12, I think it was 11 or 12, I've forgotten the exact number, Jewish civilians were killed, mostly women and children. They said, yeah, but it wasn't a terrorist act, and we did it, and we're not terrorists, we're soldiers. I said, so blowing the heads off of Jewish women and children at point blank range is not a terrorist act. That's the act of a soldier. So yeah, we didn't commit suicide. We blew the axles off the bus, and as the women and children were exiting the bus, we shot them. And I just shook these three men's hands. I was there to interview them. I wanted to know what motivated them to do such horrific things. And here they were bragging about it and bragging about the role that they played in killing. My guess is that the Muslim who attacked you and your son viewed their act, their destructive and nearly deadly act, heroically as well.
Oh, certainly. Well, they don't differentiate between civilians and soldiers. As far as they're concerned, they are fighting for the cause, okay, the cause of Islam. And anything is justified according to the Islamic mentality in the cause of Islam. This is something that it's very hard for someone in the West to understand. It's a very difficult concept for someone from the West, but it's a different mentality. That's what we have to understand, that we're dealing with a very different mentality.
David, we're up against a break. Stay with us through the commercial at the bottom here of the hour, and we'll return and speak of the very different mentality associated with Islam and what motivates them to kill, and then perhaps what we can do to stop them. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Shattering Mists. I am your host, Yada. We're here with David Rubin, calling in from Shiloh, Israel. David is not only the founder and president of the Shiloh Israel Children's Fund, but is also the author of a recent book called The Islamic Tsunami, Israel and America in the Age of Obama. David, you made a comment at the end of our last segment that said it's very difficult for those in the West to understand the Islamic mindset. Now, the Quran claims that Allah was the author of the Torah and that the Quran confirms the Torah. So how could it be that that since the mindset, the moral standard that's applied throughout the West, which is Torah-based. How could the Islamic mindset, if Allah was telling the truth, if he was the God who inspired the Torah, and if he is the, if the Quran confirms the Torah, how is it possible that their mindset, their morality, could be so different than ours?
Well, it's basically because Allah is not God. Very often we translate Allah as God. But you know the war cry in the Islamic world.
Allahu Akbar.
That's right. So what does Allahu Akbar mean?
It means Allah is greater, and it was first used at the terrorist raid of Kabar, which was a Jewish farming community in Arabia, not far from Mecca and Medina. And Muhammad was trying to prove a point. He came with thousands of men under arms to attack a defenseless Jewish farming community, and before he attacked them, he wanted to impress the Jews that his God, Allah, who is modeled after Satan, Allah spends all of his time in hell in the Quran, was greater than the God of the Torah prophets and Psalms, the God of the Yahutim, whose name is Yahweh. And so the cry, Allahu Akbar, means that Allah is greater than Yahweh.
I was going to give a much simpler answer, but the truth is that obviously you know the answer, and you knew the answer, and you know it in some detail. But generally, when I ask that question, the answer that's given is God is great, and that's when you see a Muslim demonstration, like the wild demonstrations in Iran or in. Mm-hmm. Benghazi, if you to call it a demonstration.
Or in Egypt today.
Obviously, you're talking about people who are rioting and shouting, God, it's usually translated as God is great, but the actual literal translation is God is greater. And
yeah.
That comes from the core of Islam and the root of Islam, which is that Muhammad, the founder of Islam, who, I, by the way, I will never call Muhammad the prophet,
as
many people do. We hear all these secular newscasters in America saying, Muhammad the prophet. Well, he was never a prophet, and that's the whole point.
Yes.
He was rejected by all of the Christians and the Jews on the Arabian Peninsula. And because of that, he became angry, and he said, I am going to create my own religion, my own God, who he called Allah. And then he said, and his own holy book, which he called the Quran. The Quran is not the Torah.
Okay.
The Torah is the holy book of the people of Israel, which was adopted by the Christian world. And it was given to Moses on Mount Sinai. The Quran was written down based on the teachings of Muhammad, if we can call them teachings. And it was written down, and we're going back about maximum 1,400 years. So we're talking about a completely different book. The Torah did not say that you should hunt every Jew behind a rock and kill him. The Quran did not say that you should ambush the unbelievers on the road and tear out their fingertips. The Quran did not say, do not take the Jews or the Christians as friends
of
each other.
You mean to say the Torah does not say that?
Torah does not say that, but the Quran does say it.
Yeah.
And that is the whole point. We're talking about a very different culture, which is based on jihad, which means holy war against all the what they call non-believers, meaning non-Muslims. And jihad is a religious justification for terrorism.
Correct. It's the reason why 99.9% of Muslims are terrorists.
It's not an accident that every single terrorist group in the world is Islamic. I don't know about you, but I've never heard of a terrorist organization called Baptist Jihad.
Yeah, there,
it's not
there
an accident.
At one time, in fact, I wrote a timeline, David, going back from 1960, and I summarized everything between Muhammad's creation of Islam in 1960 and then 1960, and I detailed every terrorist act perpetrated in the world. And there are a handful of non-Islamic terrorist groups. There were Tamil Tigers who modeled themselves after Islamic techniques. For a while, you had the Irish Republic Army, although they were more guerrilla in their tactics. And you had some terrorist groups like FARC that were drug smugglers and socialists in the northern parts of South America. If you go back to the 1960s, what you find is that about 70% of terrorist acts were committed by fundamentalist Muslims. And then you go into the 70s and 80s, it becomes 80% that are committed by fundamentalist Muslims. And in the 90s, and as we've moved into the 21st century, it becomes about 95%. And today, it's over 99% of terrorist acts are perpetrated by Muslims. And so one must ask why. Now, why are Muslims responsible for 99% of the world's terrorist acts? And the answer is obviously Islam. I mean, that's the only rational answer. And so all one really has to do is what you did. You you studied the Quran and the Hadith, and you came to know who Muhammad was and what Muhammad preached. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. I did what Thomas Jefferson did.
Yes.
When he was confronted, when the United States in its early years was confronted by the first recorded terrorist group in relatively modern times in the history of the United States, and that was the Barbary Pirates.
Correct.
Who were terrorizing American ships at sea. And so what did Jefferson do? He went out and he bought a copy of the Quran. It's now stored in the Jefferson Library.
Yep.
He didn't go to learn the wisdom of Islam.
No.
He went there because he went to it and he read it because he wanted to understand the mentality of those who were terrorizing American ships at sea and taking bribery money from the American government.
Yeah, it was the first. It was the first enemy that the United States, the newly formed United States government, had was Islam, and so when the president of the United States, Obama, had in his speech after he killed Osama bin Laden, who was essentially irrelevant, when he killed Osama bin Laden, he says America never has been and never will be at war with Islam. Well, the truth is, the first war that America fought was against Islam. There's actually more to the story than what you have told. Everything you said was correct.
Of course.
But Jefferson, as Secretary of State, was actually sent to negotiate with the Ottoman Empire to find out why in the world they were pirating our ships. In doing so, under a religious banner, he met with the ambassador, and the ambassador quoted from the Quran and Hadith, telling Jefferson that the prophet of Islam, and I agree with you, Muhammad's not a prophet because he never got a single prediction correct, told them to, ordered them to, specifically to raid and pirate ships, and so they were going to do so. And that the United States was compelled to present almost 25% of its GDP as a bribe to the Ottoman Empire to diminish the amount of piracy. And on the way back, Jefferson said, "Can you give me a copy of these scriptures that you are reading from, so that I can understand them?" And that's how Jefferson came to have his Quran, was to understand why Muslims kill. So you are correct. He turned to the Quran for the same reason you and I did. We wanted to know what motivated 99% of the terrorist acts perpetrated in the world today.
And in fact, in my book, The Islamic Tsunami, I did tell that whole story. And it didn't start with Jefferson. All of the early presidents were confronted with this.
Yes.
And so, but there are lessons to be learned. And but today we see how it's been twisted around. I remember there was the Muslim congressman, Keith Ellison, when he was sworn in. And,
yes.
And, scandalously, he was allowed to be sworn in on a Quran.
Because it was Jefferson's.
Yes, and he went and he got Jefferson's Quran from the library.
Yep.
And that's what he was sworn in on. He said that he's being sworn in on Thomas Jefferson's Quran because Thomas Jefferson appreciated the differences between the three great religions.
Yeah, it was one of the most egregious lies ever.
It's an absolute lie, and I can't believe that Congressman Ellison didn't know the truth.
He may have known the truth, but Muslims are taught to lie. It's why treaties with Muslims are never productive. It's the spirit of Hudaybiyah, for example. I'm sure you know the story of the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, where Muslims are specifically told that any agreement that they make with a non-Muslim is not binding on them. And Muhammad himself, every time he had an opponent, told his militants that they could lie and deceive to make their enemy easier prey.
That is absolutely correct. So we have to understand, and getting back to my original point, this is not an even playing field.
Correct.
Those who attack civilians on the roads are not playing according to an even playing field, and we have to understand that this is what we're up against, and we have to change the rules of the game.
So their mindset is entirely different. You know what I'd like to do is you're living there in the bullseye of the Islamic arsenal. There's nothing that Muslims want more than to reclaim all of Israel, but starting with they've already started with Gaza, so they have that back. That was rather foolish, and now they want the West Bank. What do you think can be wielded against them that would be effective? I have my conclusion, but after the break, I would like to hear your thoughts on what would be the most effective weapon or implement that could be wielded against this Islamic tsunami. We'll return with our conversation with David Rubin, who is the author of The Islamic Tsunami, Israel and America in the Age of Obama, after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're here with David Rubin, who is the founder and president of the Shiloh Israel Children's Fund. He lives and is calling in from Shiloh, Israel today. He's also the author of The Islamic Tsunami, Israel and America in the Age of Obama. At the end of the last segment, David, I asked you a question, which is that now that we understand the source of their rage, what can be done to thwart the Islamic desire to kill every Jew and to wipe Israel off the face of the map?
Well, I think it was Ronald Reagan who used to state very clearly in his battle with the former Soviet Union that true peace can only be achieved through strength and through always standing by our principles. And I think that's something that we need to remember. The end goal is to stand by your principles and stand by the values that you believe in. This is something that the Muslims understand, even though their values are very very perverse. But we who live in the West, in Israel, in the United States, who stand by a civilization that traces its roots back to the Torah, back to the Bible of Israel, I think that we're coming from a very valid place, values-wise. And we need to stand by those values, stand by those principles, and achieve peace through strength. There is no reason why we have to be compromising with those who wish to destroy us. Just as Winston Churchill, when he was confronted with the Nazis, he understood that when you are confronted with evil, you have to stand up to the evil. And the Allies defeated Nazism. I don't adhere to the philosophy that says that you cannot defeat an ideology through war. You can defeat an ideology through war, and there are some cases where you need to, where there is such a thing as a just war. And what was done against the Nazis in World War II was justified. And we are going to have to stand with strength against this Islamic force, which is, I believe, worse than Nazism.
Well, there's a lot of correlation between Nazism and Islam, to be sure. As a matter of fact, in my book on Islam, my second book, which is called Prophet of Doom, I dedicate 77 pages of that 1,000-page book to juxtaposing Hitler's Mein Kampf to the Islamic Quran and Hadith to show that apart from people and time and place, that the rant is identical. Personally, I am not a believer an ideology like Islam can be defeated with force of arms. Now, my perspective, of course, is different than someone living in Israel. I recognize that if Israel did not have a stout military, it would have lost all three major wars perpetrated against it by Muslims. And so I fully appreciate that reality. If I were president and could influence this, the first thing I would do is stop giving weapons to the Muslims. If the West, and particularly America, wasn't equipping the enemies of Israel, Israel would be a great deal easier to defend. And I think it is a great tragedy that we send $70 billion worth of advanced weapons to Saudi Arabia, and that we send the tooling to manufacture A1 Abrams tanks to Egypt when these countries are avowed enemies of Israel. I also think that it was that America is making the situation worse for Israel when it invaded Iraq and gave Iraq to Iran. We made Iran vastly more influential in the region, and we created the environment that whereby Iran could develop their nuclear weapon because they would no longer had an enemy in Iraq. But David, I'll tell you one thing: we agree wholly on the issue of principles. And I think that's the problem that exists for both of our nations. There are very few people of principle. Very few people actually know God. Very few people know His Torah. Very few people know that He is not the God of weaklings. He wants people to stand up, bow their back, and fight this enemy. David, we had an abbreviated show today with you. Love to have you back. I'd love to trace the Jewish claim to the land back to the stories that are presented in the Torah, and then trace the history of the Islamic assault on the land with you on another program.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, that I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact.